This is Orson Welles.
This is a sort of impertinent question. I wanted to ask you if you have ever cast a friend instead of the right person for the part.
Frequently.
Have you regretted it?
Frequently.
Would you do it again?
Yes.
Do you think?
Because I don't regard art as of prime importance. I already told you I prefer every other loyalty in life to art. I hate the romantic conception of art as taking precedence over anything. I think it's the last thing to be considered, always. Certainly would regard friendship as more important than my art. I have great respect for people who do regard their art in that way. And I think they are probably the most valuable artists. So I'm not defining what an artist ought to be. I'm just saying the kind of artist I am.
Hi, and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 33. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at the later career of Orson Welles. As people might recall, a few podcasts ago I talked about Citizen Kane, among other films, and I kind of got stuck in an Orson Welles kind of headspace. Orson Welles was always a person who had the ability to mesmerize an audience, and I think I got sucked into that a little bit. So I kind of looked at his later career. So here's what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be looking at three of his later films. So the ones after he left Hollywood and traveled to Europe for a while. So the three films are Confidential Report, also known as Mr. Arkadin, Touch of Evil, which was his last big Hollywood hurrah, and F for Fake, the last full film that Orson Welles completed, and in some ways a kind of epiphany for him. So I'm going to be looking at that, but I'll let Sal get the introductory stuff out of the way. I'll look at a few emails that I received and a few messages, and I'll get stuck into the very seductive life of Orson Welles.
Paleo Cinema is a three-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction, and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback, and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode, is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast contains adult content and occasional swearing, so don't lend your MP3 player to children.
Okay, the first email I got was from Doug Waltz in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Isn't there a song about that? Something along those lines. Anyway, Doug says, I've been listening to your podcast off and on for a while. I thought I would finally comment on it. First, let me say that the subject matter is terrific and the tone of your voice is perfectly made for podcasting, so keep up the good work. Podcast 32 has me tracking down a copy of Branded to Kill, which sounds like a truly amazing film that I can't wait to see. It was fun hearing from your lovely wife at the end of the episode. Maybe you should give her more of a regular part in the podcast in the future. Thanks again for the excellent podcast, and if you get a chance, you should check out my website, Divine Exploitation, at http://divineexploitation.blogspot.com. Yep, great. Thanks for that, Doug, and I'm glad to give you a plug. I also put a link on the site to your site. So, yeah, I would have more of Sal on the podcast, but classic films less of an interest for her, as you might have noted from what she said last time. But now and then I'll get her to pop in, I'll get her drunk, I'll blackmail her, I'll do what I need to do, and we'll just have a brief chat along the line. So she will be returning to the podcast at some stage, but I've got to catch her in the right mood to get her to do that. But yeah, thank you for the feedback. It's always good to get that. And I will be keeping up the work. I enjoy this, particularly when I'm inspired. There are times when you think, what am I going to talk about? What am I going to do next? But inevitably something does come along. Something piques my interest. I want to try not to repeat myself, occasionally do, but I do want to kind of avoid that. And if I'm going to be covering ground that I've covered before, I think I'll try to find a new spin on it or a new aspect of it. So I really appreciate that, Doug. And, yeah, I like your website. And I advise other people to go and see it too. It is good. It doesn't cover a lot of the same stuff I do, which I like. Thanks again, and please do keep listening. I also heard from an old friend of mine called Mitch. Mitch always goes by just Mitch, so I'm going to refer to him in that way. And Mitch talked to me about a lot of other stuff, but he also said, the main reason I remembered to reply to this is because I got myself an iPhone a few weeks back, and I've gotten into podcasts big time. I downloaded yours for a short period, but never finding time to listen to them and stopped downloading. Needless to say, I figured this iTunes thing out and the iPhone, and I'm now making time to listen to a bunch of casts, including yours. I'm just now listening to your music special, and you mentioned a desire to get Fathom with Raquel Welch. I have a copy if you still need it. Nah, thanks, Mitch. I've already got it. Anyway, congrats on the podcast. I really am enjoying it. Hope to catch up with you soon. Yeah, we've got to catch up. We've got a few things we need to swap. So thank you for the feedback. I do like getting feedback from anybody, but when it's people that I've known for a while and who are honest enough friends to give me honest appraisals of things, it sometimes means nice things in a different way than the usual stuff. So, yeah, great. Thank you very much. I also heard from our old friend Serps. Things are going well for Serps, and he said he was going to write me a longer reply later on, but he just wanted to touch base. So I'll just name check him here. Thank you, Serps. I'm glad things are going great for you, mate, and I hope they continue to do so. And, of course, if people want to check out your blog, it's at thelandofserpsandhoney.blogspot.com, I believe. Also got a few messages on Twitter from people like Kyle Nip, so thank you for that. I believe Troy Date I've heard a few things from as well, so thanks for that, guys. Twitter comments are always appreciated. I like the immediacy of them, I like the brevity of them, and I will always kind of name check and say thank you to people who do deliver feedback that way. Anyway, it's probably time I got on with the podcast and with the subject of the day. So, talking about Orson Welles. In a lot of ways, Orson Welles was the most interesting filmmaker of the 20th century. The man and his movies are tightly bound together in a way that doesn't occur with any other filmmaker, possibly with the exception of Alfred Hitchcock, though Hitchcock's personal life was a lot less interesting than Welles. Welles' genius for filmmaking and self-promotion combined with his self-destructive streak when it came to dealing with movie studios and independent investors in his films makes his story kind of as interesting. The story of how he makes the movies is as interesting as the stories of the films himself. He was an insecure man in some ways, but very bombastic, a mediocre actor at times, and also one of the great dramatic voices of the last century. He was a film genius who could only perform as a genius when his attention didn't waver, and he had collaborators like Herman Mankiewicz and John Houseman and Russell Mehta and Greg Toland, who could ensure that it didn't. Basically, when he had other people around him who were at his level, Welles always came to the game, and that's the interesting thing. He could lose interest in a film very easily. So he needed that interaction with other people working with him to really ensure that a film got completed and got completed the way he did and didn't end up among the vast archive of Orson Welles films that unfortunately have not yet been seen. But Welles wasn't always a great actor, but he was a great director and storyteller and a great entertainer. His first movie, Citizen Kane, is about a palace built by an extraordinary man, and yet Welles himself spent much of his adult life as a nomad. Particularly in the 1950s, he moved from country to country through Europe, project to project, until finally, in his last years of his life, when he was back in Los Angeles, he lived in a tract home, and the backyard was littered with his discarded cigar butts. So, Orson Welles, in a sense, the end of his life can be perceived as being sad, but I've got a slightly different viewpoint on it now. I used to have that viewpoint, but I've now changed, and I'll explain why a little later when we talk about If a Fake. Welles was also a conjurer, a huckster, a faker, a con man, and a monolithic egotist. And the best thing he ever invented was Orson Welles. He was a cinematic sorcerer with the power to mesmerize an audience. I've seen some documentary footage on him. There's a documentary called Orson Welles, one-man band.
The one-man band is coming. Dig my street box oven. That's new. Drum, drum, drum. And here comes the one-man band.
Is coming. Take that music coming. That's me. Drum, drum, drum. And here
comes the one-man band. The one-man band is coming. Here comes the one-man band.
Where he's talking with a whole bunch of film students in maybe late 70s, early 80s. Before, yeah, he died in 1985, so would have been maybe late 1970s. And he mesmerizes them. He's amused. He's a bit cranky about various questions that come up. But in general, he has this audience of young, cynical film students in the palm of his hand. And it's an interesting piece of the documentary to see that. And I do recommend that you see it. It is on the Criterion edition of F for Fake, that documentary. It's also on the Australian edition, which was released by Madman Video. And that's the edition that I watch. But I'm jumping ahead of myself. This time around, I'm talking about the three Orson Welles films that I find most interesting in his later career. Mr. Arkadin, also known as Confidential Report, Touch of Evil, and F for Fake. So, Mr. Arkadin. As I said, it's also known as Confidential Report, which is a much less interesting title. It's a kind of nebulous film. The Criterion Edition, released in DVD in 2007, cites that there are seven different versions of Mr. Arkadin, including a radio play and a novel. And in a way, it's not a film at all. It's a whole bunch of films, almost as if there were versions of the movie from five different alternate universes that have all been delivered to us. Three of them are on the three-disc Criterion set, including a reconstruction to more or less Welles' original conception of the film. And the thing to remember about Mr. Arkadin, I'll call it by that name because Confidential Report's a bit blur, is that there's no definitive version of this film. There was a version opened in London in August 1955. There's a Spanish-language version that was released in Madrid at around the same time. A French version escaped in June 1956. And the film wasn't released in America until 1962. So, very checkered history. Here's the plot line. I won't actually tell you it myself. Shannon Marinko from the Bazura Project did a TV bit about Confidential Report for some introductions the Bazura guys were doing for movies about a year ago. And Shannon's given me permission to share with you his précis of the plot line of Mr. Arkadin, also known as Confidential Report.
Robert Arden plays small-time American smuggler Guy Van Stratton, who was hired by the elusive billionaire Gregory Arkadin, Orson Welles, to investigate the tycoon's own past, as he claims to have no memory of it. Van Stratton gradually puts the pieces of Arkadin's life together, but the more he digs, the more people turn up dead, as he discovers that Arkadin is motivated not by amnesia, but by a need to keep a secret from his daughter.
Thanks for that one, Shannon, and also to Lee, who's the other half of the Bazura Project, and you guys rock. I mean, in an Australian world of movie buffs, you guys are the go-to guys for anything really interesting. There are the older school people like David and Margaret and any number of other people, including Bill Collins, but as far as passion, imagination, and just general entertainment value, you guys exceed those venerable movie reviewers of the Australian television scene. And yeah, you can blush now. Okay, the movie's genesis. It started as an episode of Orson Welles' English-produced radio show, The Lives of Harry Lime. The radio show Harry Lime has bugger all in common with the Harry Lime from The Third Man, except the name, the voice, and the zither music. But they're fun to listen to, and you can actually find them on the web. If you Google The Lives of Harry Lime and follow your mouse, I think you'll find that you'll be able to download any number of them in MP3 format, and they are quite amusing. The novel Mr. Arkadin, which I read many years ago, came out in 1952. Welles claimed at various stages that it was ghostwritten by a guy called Maurice Bessie. But towards his later years, he admitted that it was his own work. It isn't, as I recall it, a very good novel. It's all over the place, and it seems like a very much a rush job. Now, Welles' producer for Arkadin was a guy called Louis Dolivet, who was the husband of the actress Beatrice Straight, and for whom Welles had worked during World War II writing articles for Dolivet's magazine Free World. Now, Dolivet was a Romanian who became Wells' patron in the 1950s, arranging finance for him during the times Wells spent in Europe. At the time of Arcadin, Wells was drinking really heavily. And he was at his most erratic. He wasn't a reliable movie maker. He came up with spur-of-the-moment ideas during the making of films, and of course they ended up costing more and taking longer. And he seemed to have the attention span of a teenager with ADHD. And he was prone to angry outbursts of temper, which he later smoothed over with a display of his charm. And it wasn't the best way to get a movie made. Wells' original intention was to have Arcadin told as a flashback, similar to the structure of Citizen Kane, with which it shares a lot of qualities. In fact, Confidential Report, Mr. Arcadin, has echoes of a lot of Wells' previous films. But Wells, as a film editor, was too slow for Dolivet, who on Christmas Eve 1954 took the film away from him and had it recut as a straight sequential narrative. Now, for some reason, this cut, which is the one I've viewed, has a really breakneck pace. It's flat-out, full-on, rushed job kind of pace. The scenes are all vignettes, little bits of business by interesting but hammy actors, including Michael Redgrave, Akim Tamarov, and Misha Auer, who has a really nice little cameo as the operator of a flea circus. I'll give you a bit of a soundbite now from the trailer for Mr. Arcadin, and then we'll move on.
Two names given to a stranger, and one of them is Arcadin, Gregory Arcadin. This is Raina, his daughter. Pity the man who falls in love with her, for Arcadin is a dangerous man and a jealous one. Be warned, then. Keep clear of Gregory Arcadin, for he has a way of dealing with his enemies and his friends, particularly his very old friends.
I want you to make an investigation and prepare me a report.
Report? Report on what?
Gregory Arcadin.
Okay, Mr. Arcadin, I'll buy it. Who were you?
I do not know who I am.
You're going after Arcadin's money in your own way through his daughter, aren't you? Well, you better watch your step or I might decide to start talking.
In stricken little alleyways, people who once looked like human beings are being tormented to talk about Gregory Arcadin.
Visually, historically, and stylistically, this is a fascinating movie in spite of the fact that it was butchered. It seems to blend Citizen Kane with The Third Man, The Stranger, and Lady from Shanghai in a blender. The world that's built is a world of post-World War II European poverty and also rich people's decadence and intrigue, and it's all beautifully drawn. Yeah, the pace is staccato and too punchy, and the characters are more caricature than realistic. Nonetheless, even bad Wells is interesting Wells. It has a lot of the film, particularly a lot of the dialogue shots that are shot from below looking upwards to the actors and the scenery behind them in a kind of deep focus that Wells had learned from Greg Toland during the making of Citizen Kane. So there are a lot of visual reference points to that where characters are talking and there are castles in the background in the landscape, and it's interesting the way he frames that. Now, Robert Arden, the actor who played Van Stratton, had worked for Wells in the Harry Lime radio series. He was in a London production of Guys and Dolls when Wells called him up halfway through a performance and said, you know, come to Madrid, I want you to be in a movie. Next day, Sir Carol Reed, who had directed Wells in The Third Man, arranged to buy out Arden's contract for the musical, and 24 hours later he was on a plane to Madrid with a whole bunch of his clothing, which Wells needed for the character. The budget in this film was low. They, amongst other things, they raided their hotel rooms for set decoration. So Orson Welles would be in his hotel room and go, okay, I need that, and that, and just basically take the stuff out of the hotel room to use in the movie. Really breakneck pace during the making of the film, but the editing process went slow. Paola Mori, the actress who plays Arcadin's daughter Raina, was Welles' mistress and later on his wife. She was, being honest about it, really a bit of a bad actress. Wells tried to improve her English by sending her to stay with some Irish actor friends of his in Ireland for a few weeks, but when she came back, she still had an accent as thick as a lasagna, so her voice in the film was eventually dubbed by a very young Billy Whitelaw. Patricia Medina, who played Van Stratton's girlfriend Millie, was a Liverpool-born half-English, half-Spanish actress who in 1950 had married Wells' old friend Joseph Cotton. You even get to see Gert Frober, who played Goldfinger, in a small role as a Munich policeman a decade before he hit the golf course with Oddjob. So I'm going to have to... I've decided after having seen Confidential Report again, I'm going to have to track down the 3-disc Criterion edition, because I kind of want to see a definitive edition of this film. I realise it's one of Welles' lesser works and that the characterisation just simply doesn't work in it, but I do find it very interesting. Welles in the role of Arkadin's very much a caricature. He's like a malevolent Santa Claus in some ways. It's an odd piece of acting with a very fake-looking beard and a very fake-looking wig and a very bombastic manner. I'll give you a soundbite just to explain what I mean, but in a sense, Mr. Arkadin is Welles at a low point. It was Welles at his most erratic. He didn't have that collaboration that he needed for him to function at the top of his game. And I think in some ways he realized this and moved back to Los Angeles, and in a way that took him on the path towards making Touch of Evil. He kind of wanted to pick himself up, dust himself off, start all over again. And he did so. But I'll just play that end bit of dialogue by Orson Welles as Gregory Arkadin, and then we'll move on to talk about Touch of Evil.
Now I'm going to tell you about a scorpion. This scorpion wanted to cross a river. So he asked the frog to carry him. No, said the frog, no, thank you. If I let you on my back, you may sting me, and the sting of a scorpion is death. Now, whereas the scorpion is the logic of death, for scorpions always try to be logical. If I sting you, you will die. I will drown. So the frog was convinced and allowed the scorpion on his back. But just in the middle of the river, he felt a terrible pain and realized that, after all, the scorpion had stung him. Logic, cried the dying frog as he started under bearing the scorpion down with him. There is no logic in this. I know, said the scorpion, but I can't help it. It's my character. Let's drink to character.
Okay, we move on to 1959. Orson Welles went back to Hollywood and he did a few character roles. He'd worked in Ireland with John Huston in a small but important cameo role in Moby Dick, which I recommend you see. The scene with Orson Welles as the preacher in Moby Dick is among Welles' finest work. It's incredibly adept piece of acting, and it did impress people, and in a sense, Hollywood drew Welles back into the fold. He did a couple of character roles as an actor, not as a director, but as an actor. And there are some stories about how he came to work about work in Touch of Evil, but I'll start talking about Touch of Evil and I'll incorporate that into it. Okay, once upon a time there was a pulp novel called Badge of Evil by a guy called Whit Masterson. Now, how this novel evolved into Orson Welles' Touch of Evil is... there are a number of different stories about how this occurred. Some versions say that Welles was originally hired as an actor to play the corrupt border cop Hank Quinlan, and that the star of the movie, Charlton Heston, or so the story goes, who was just on a roll having just won an Oscar for Ben-Hur, suggested that Welles be given the opportunity to direct. The studio people went away, came back and said, okay. Another version of the story... It says that William Alland, who had worked with Welles in Citizen Kane, he was the unseen investigator who interviewed the people in Kane's life, had become a big executive at Universal Studios, and he used his clout to get Welles the gig. The third version says that Welles, having worked with the producer Albert Zugsmith on a Jeff Chandler movie called Man in the Shadow, which I'm going to try to get a copy of at some stage just to see it. It is out on DVD. Was offered a pile of scripts by Zugsmith, who wanted him to direct a movie for him. Zugsmith was a B-grade producer. He wasn't at the top of the Universal hierarchy. Welles asked him for the worst script in the pile to prove that he could make a great film from a bad script. The story goes that Badge of Evil was that script. So maybe the truth somewhere in the middle, that you know, Heston did recommend him and Alland as a studio producer gave his backing to it, and Zugsmith as another producer went to bat for him as well. We'll probably never know what the real story is, but it doesn't really matter that much. there's a lot of unreliable narrative in any history of Orson Welles, and we just got to accept that and move along. So Welles had decided to prove to Hollywood studios that he could work fast and work well. He rewrote the whole script of the film in 4.5 days. And he was very hands-on when it came to the production of the movie too. For instance, he had suits made for Charlton Heston's character, who's a Mexican investigator, by the best Mexican tailor in Los Angeles, because he wanted him to have that look. So he kind of went into the detail of it to an extent that really showed that he was worthy of directing a studio picture with a major Hollywood star at the time. Do I have to go on the synopsis of the movie? I mean, you guys know movies. You may well have seen Touch of Evil. If you haven't, basically the movie opens with a 3.5-minute tracking shot, which sets up the whole plot. I won't spoil it for you if you haven't seen the movie. If you have seen the movie, you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you haven't, I'll let you just enjoy it without foreshadowing it. And I recommend that everyone sees this. If you're going to be a film buff, this is one of the go-to movies to be able to discuss film. It's really Welles coming back to his best game. He had a fantastic director of photography, Russell Metty, who worked with him incredibly well. He had a good cast. He had the studio backing. He was originally going to make the film in Acapulco or Tijuana or somewhere like that in Mexico, but the studio insisted that he make it in Venice, California, which was very run down at the time, and Welles turned it into the kind of archetypal Mexican border town of film noir. And in a lot of ways, a lot of people have said this film is the last great film noir of the classic era. Charlton Heston plays Miguel Vargas, a Mexican drug enforcement cop who has married a white Anglo woman, Susie, played by Janet Leigh. Originally, in the original script, the races of the two characters, Susie and Miguel, were reversed. He was a white guy with a Mexican wife called Connie, but Welles changed that in order to ramp up the tension during the scenes where she's being terrorized by a gang of Mexican criminals in a hotel room run by, where the hotel is run by Dennis Weaver, playing a very jittery and crazy innkeeper in a sense, which kind of foreshadows Anthony Perkins in Psycho in some ways. Yeah, and basically there's border intrigue, there's the corrupt American border cop Hank Quinlan, played by Welles, at his most grotesque. And first time I saw this film was only about 10 years ago. I went to see the re-edited edition, the 1998 cut, with my old mate Jamie at the Astor Theatre, which is an old classic Art Deco cinema in Melbourne. And we enjoyed it a lot. I'd heard about the film. I'd seen the extended 3.5-minute take at the start of the film, but I hadn't really seen it before, I don't think, before we saw that cut, which, I probably should talk about this. The film was butchered by the studio. Again, Welles, as an editor, was not quick, or as quick as the people he made films for would like him to have been. So the film was taken away by the studio. There was a 55-page document to the studio that Welles outlined the way he wanted to cut the film, which is the basis of that redone version from 1998. But they cut it and basically butchered the film, as indeed people had with many Orson Welles films over the years. There are any number of them, what going as far back as The Magnificent Ambersons, where the studio took over from Welles and released product that wasn't up to the way he wanted it to be. One of the great tragedies of cinema in some ways. But I'd seen the revised cut, fantastic. They took the titles and the music away from that first 3.5 minutes, unlike the original version. Total ruination of a magnificent piece of cinema. And I loved it. I remember we talked, walking all the way down Chapel Street in Paran. We talked about the movie until we finally had to basically go home. So it is one of those great things. And Welles, apart from having Russell Metty as a collaborator with him, brought in a whole bunch of actors that he'd worked with before, people like Akim Tamaroff and Joseph Kalea and Ray Collins. And there's even a bit with Joseph Cotten in a tiny, tiny cameo role as a cop. And, of course, Marlene Dietrich playing Tanner, the madam that Quinlan meets in a brothel on the border town, and with whom he has some of the best dialogue in the movie. Wells and Dietrich had had an affair in the 1940s, so a lot of the dialogue that Marlene Dietrich says about the Hank Quinlan character looking really bad has that kind of slight edge to it, because Wells himself was older and heavier than he had been. But he actually made himself up to be more of a grotesque for the character of Hank Quinlan. He padded his body, he had a bulbous fake nose put on, he had artificial pouches under his eyes and all sorts of things like that, and lots of makeup to make himself look like he was about a half a hot dog away from a heart attack. And in some ways that Quinlan plays off very well against Heston as the straight arrow Vargas character. And this film is full of great cinematic moments. There's a piece in a hotel room where Quinlan plants evidence to set somebody up, and ultimately him planting that evidence is where he comes undone and where it's discovered that he is a corrupt cop, and ultimately leads to his death. Where the camera, they had 3 days laid out for this very complicated scene in the hotel room, where they were going to have to, you know, cut to various bits and pieces and just tell the story of how Quinlan's planting the evidence and how Vargas discovers that Quinlan is a corrupt cop and has planted the evidence. But Wells and Meddy just got together in the morning, went bam, 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 we're going to do it this way. They filmed it in one or two takes with no cutting, and except a cutaway to the shoebox, which is a very important part of the plot. But apart from that, they did it very quickly, and they'd had it finished by lunchtime. And this stunned everybody. There were, of course, studio spies around to make sure that Wells wasn't acting up and wasn't acting wastefully with their resources. And everybody who saw this was incredibly impressed by it. But that's not the scene that I find very impressive in this movie, nor is the 3.5-minute tracking shot. The bit that I find most impressive in this film is there's a bit where a bunch of characters walk into a very small elevator in a hotel, take the lift up and get out of it again. Now, this is done on location. It's not done on a set. And the lights and the cameraman and the characters are all in this tiny elevator and move up to another hotel room and get out of it. And apparently they had to snake cables and lighting in this elevator shaft. They were working in incredibly cramped circumstances. The lenses and the lighting had to be special for it. But without drawing attention to itself too much, that's the bit that really got me in this film. This is one of the classics of cinema. It is, in a sense, it's one of the redemptions of Orson Welles. He'd made Confidential Report, of course, which was butchered. He'd done a number of projects in Europe, which unfortunately didn't come to fruition. He travelled around. He was drunk. He had debts. He had financial problems. But then he came back to Hollywood, did a couple of acting roles, and then hit Hollywood with Touch of Evil. Wasn't a big success financially at the time, but it's now a classic of cinema. Of course, Universal have made their money back any number of times from the fact that this film is a classic and that people buy it on DVD. It's shown to cinema students, and it's one of the best-known movies in the world, apart from, of course, Citizen Kane and all those other movies that get onto the best lists. In that sense, it's got a long tail. It made money for a long period of time for the studios when they bothered to make it available to the public. And of course, during the 60s, that was a hard thing to do. People wanted a new product in cinemas. This was before video. But when the video revolution came along, this is when classic films like Touch of Evil really started turning into cash cows for the studios. Now, I'll just end this bit with some of the dialogue from the end of Touch of Evil, including Marlene Dietrich giving a eulogy for the Hank Quinlan character. And we'll move on to talk to Wells' last great film, and in a lot of senses, his most playful film, F for Fake.
His famous intuition was right after all. He framed that Mexican kid Sanchez, but he didn't even need to. The kid confessed about that bomb. So turns out Quinlan was right after all.
Isn't somebody going to come and take him away?
Yeah, in just a few minutes. You really liked him, didn't you?
The cop did. The one who killed him. He loved him.
Well, Hank was a great detective, all right.
And a lousy cop.
Is that all you have to say for him?
He was some kind of a man. What does it matter what you say about people?
Goodbye, Tanner.
Adios.
Next experiment, ladies and gentlemen, I would appreciate the loan of any small personal object from your pocket, a key, a box of matches, a coin.
Here it is. Good, sir. Hold it up 10 feet over your head and watch out for the slightest hint of hanky-panky. And behold, before our very eyes, a transformation. We've changed your key into a coin. What happened to the key? It's been returned to you. Look closely, sir. You'll find the key back in your pocket.
Back in the days when VHS recorders were about the size of a small suitcase, I bought my first VHS recorder. I was living in Sydney at the time, and the very first thing I taped off television to watch and to keep was F for Fake. I'd heard about it. It was very hard to find. Got to remember, this is in the very early days of videotapes. And so for years, I carried around a VHS copy of F for Fake, which over the years, of course, deteriorated the way VHS copies did, particularly when taped off the television. And treasured it, because this is a fun, playful essay. It's not quite a movie. It's an essay. It's a mosaic, it's a montage, it's Wells playing games with cinema. And it's about trickery, it's about fakery, it's about art forgers, it's about literary forgers, it's about Pablo Picasso and art and the nature of art and the nature of filmmaking and the nature of Orson Welles and his relationship with his muse and collaborator and lover, Oyo Koda. It's a movie which defies categorization. It's not quite a documentary, because Wells incorporated documentary footage by a guy called Francois Reichenbach, who appears in the film as one of the people in the film, who did a documentary that Wells had seen on the famous art forger Elmire Dehori, who was one of the other subjects of the film. And Wells incorporated Reichenbach's footage with his collaboration too into the game that he's playing with this film, F for Fake. It starts out with, as that soundbite indicates, Wells on a train station doing little bits of sleight of hand magic for a little boy. And that also introduces Oya Koda, who was a very, very attractive woman and very charismatic, and whom Wells wanted to make into a big movie star, but which, of course, never eventuated, though she does have her place in cinema history as Wells' last great collaborator and the guardian of his film legacy.
After your old tricks, I see.
Why not? I'm a charlatan. What's that, sir? Did I used to be a magician, sir? I'm still working on it.
In a lot of ways, this is the last hurrah for Orson Welles. The film was released 10 years before his death, and I was listening to the commentary footage on the Australian version of the DVD, which is by one of our film critics here, Adrian Martin, which has kind of made me reevaluate the later career of Orson Welles. Martin makes the point that there's a lot of talk about the end of Orson Welles' career, where he did TV commercials and played the voice of a character in the Transformers movie, the first Transformers movie, and where he worked with Muppets and Burt Reynolds and other unworthy characters and all that sort of thing. But Martin's observation is this. Welles did these commercial projects for which he was incredibly well paid, the TV commercials, the cameo roles, the guest spots, all those sorts of things. in order to pay for his films. Around the same time as F for Fake, he was making a movie which I have heard will be appearing in Cannes in 2010, The Other Side of the Wind. It was a movie he was making with John Huston, Peter Bogdanovich, Susan Strasberg, a number of other quality actors. And some of the footage for this appears in Orson Welles' One Man Band, the documentary. There's a sex scene with Oya Kodar and a young guy in the front of a pickup truck, which is unlike any sex scene I've kind of seen in any kind of commercial film. It's incredibly erotic and filmed very cheaply, but very interestingly, with a few subjective point of view shots and then cut to another character who's in the car with them. It's an incredible piece of filmmaking, and it's really made me hungry to see a completed version of Other Side of the Wind, which all the footage is there, it just hasn't been edited yet, and it's in the process of being edited as we speak. Bogdanovich is in collaboration with Oya Kodar and a number of other stakeholders to get this film actually released for Cannes in 2010. So, but I'm digressing. Wells did all those commercial things in order to pay for films like F for Fake and The Other Side of the Wind and the other projects that he was working on. He always, one of the things about Wells is, in his later life, he carried around a film editing deck as part of his luggage. He'd bring cans of film with him wherever he travelled, and he had a portable film editing deck which he carried around as a piece of luggage so he could continue to work on these projects, some of which he filmed 25 years before and were never completed, but with which he always had the intention of completing them. One of the things about the structure of F for Fake that roll into this is, it is a montage of Reichenbach's footage, Wells playing with editing, Wells pulling a magic trick during the film, and a con trick as well. There are magic tricks, there are con tricks in this film, where Wells' skill with editing, his mastery of editing, make the trick work. Now, first time I saw the film, I knew what the trick would be. I picked it up on it very early, and it didn't matter one damn bit that I did, because Wells seduces the audience into going along for the ride.
Ladies and gentlemen, by way of introduction, this is a film about trickery and fraud, about lies. Tell it by the fireside or in a marketplace or in a movie. Almost any story is almost certainly some kind of lie. But not this time. No, this is a promise. During the next hour, everything you'll hear from us is really true and based on solid facts.
From the moment Wells says that, he rolls on to speak about Elmer de Hoory, the art forger who's living in Ibiza, and who meets Clifford Irving, who had written a book about fakes, which included some talk about Elmer de Hoory. But at the same time this was occurring, Clifford Irving was also pulling a hoax of his own. He'd written a biography which claimed to be the autobiography of Howard Hughes. Of course, it turned out that it wasn't. And Irving spent some jail time for fraud. So the man who'd written a book about frauds himself perpetrated a large fraud, which was a big cause célèbre at the time, around the 1970s. And there's footage of de Hoory and Irving together, seem to be talking to each other. Orson Welles seems to be talking to them, even though he wasn't anywhere near there at the time. Welles cut the story together to include himself in the narrative. He didn't lie. He just let people believe certain things about the way he was editing the film. If you haven't seen this film, it is hard to describe without, of course, going to the sound clips and without showing you video of it. But I've got some good news for you. Anybody that can get this podcast can go to YouTube. All 9 parts of F for Fake are available for you to watch on YouTube. So if you're not able to get a DVD copy of it, you can get it from there. It's not hard to learn how to download video from YouTube if you are so inclined. But if you just want to watch it, it is there for you to enjoy. Just watch the first bit. It's about 8 to 10 minutes long. If you watch the first bit, you're going to get sucked into the story. Orson Welles playing with the medium of cinema, having that last great fun frolic with the medium that he loved very much and that very much was a part of his life and defined most of his life. more than, even though he did do enormously adept things on the stage, he did a version of Moby Dick in Paris, which was entirely on a stage, about whaling and about obsession and about the nature of that. To be able to do it on the stage alone shows that Wells wasn't just a cinematic genius, he was also a theatrical genius in a lot of ways. But again, when you talk about Wells, you've got to digress to other things. One of the other aspects to this film that I really like is the fact that it is a love letter to Oya Kodar, the last great love of Wells's life. And there are some bits of tasteful and discreet nudity that show that Oya Kodar was a beautiful woman. But when there is dialogue between the two of them, it brings across a sense that very much she was Wells' equal. She was a very intelligent woman as well as a beautiful one. And there's a playfulness in the dialogue between the two, which conveys the genuine love and affection and respect with which they held each other. And I like that. It's a revealing of Wells the man rather than Wells the phenomenon, and Wells the director and Wells the genius, that I found very interesting while watching this film. It's in maybe the top two or three of my favourite of his films, mostly because it's contemporary in the sense that it's in colour and it's got a narrative structure that a lot of people have adopted since then to make essay films or documentary type films. I do like Wells in this film. I have an immense fondness for him as a person based upon this film and based upon the fact that it's not Wells playing a role, it's Wells playing the role of Wells in a sense. If you haven't seen It for Fake, please do go to YouTube and avail yourself of it. And it's got a lot of things going for it. It's got the structure, it's got Wells being playful, it's got a very good kind of free-flowing jazz score by Michel Legrand, who we know from my indulgence in looking at Umbrellas of Cherbourg and The Young Girls of Rochefort in one of our podcasts. Is a movie composer for whom I have a lot of respect and a lot of time and a lot of love for his work. But F for Fake, it's a fantastic piece of cinema. And it is unlike any other film in a lot of ways, in that it takes real-world events and mixes them with fantasy and in a very intellectually rigorous way, shows how fakery works and how art works and how people's passion for art can lead them to be sucked into fakery, just as our passion for cinema leads us to be sucked into Wells fakery in this film. And I think everybody should have a copy of. I say that about every film I talk about, so just indulge me on this. But I'll leave with the last sound clip of that and I'll finish up the cast.
And then there was another distraction. Far more disturbing. Oya. Oya in the morning, on her way to the beach. Oya tan, coming back for the suntan lotion. To the beach again. And back once more. At noon for lunch. In that climate, after lunch, one takes a siesta. Not Oya, and not Picasso either. Cocktail time. Dinner time. Any time. Oya on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and all through the week. Week after week. Oya checking on the trombone. Oya escaping from it. But no escaping for Picasso.
Okay, that's about it for this time around. I've really enjoyed doing this podcast. I think doing the research on Orson Welles, one of the interesting things about it, and I'll just share this with you anyway, is the fact that there's such a wealth of information about Welles out there. The hard thing is working out what to tell and what not to tell. So if I missed out any aspects of the story that you're particularly fond of, the story of Orson Welles' later career, let me know. I mean, I did have a lot of other information, but I'll leave you with one story about Orson Welles that I haven't seen written down anywhere, but that I heard once upon a time while talking with somebody. It's the 1950s. Orson Welles is in the south of France on the beach on a balcony with a very, very attractive woman. He's doing a card trick. He's playing cards and he's getting the woman to pick a card from the deck. She picks a card. For the sake of the story, we'll say it's a three of clubs. So Welles shuffles the deck after she puts the card back into it. Shuffles the deck, smiles, puts the deck down and says, "Look behind you." The woman turns around, looks in the sky, and above the skies of Saint-Tropez, a skywriting plane has written three of clubs in the sky. That story may be totally apocryphal, but it's just one of those Orson Welles stories that sounds consistent with what we know of him. Okay, that's about it for the podcast. As I said, and as Sally said at the beginning of the podcast, if you have any comments, please give them to kultguru@gmail.com. The website is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. I'll be back in 3 weeks' time, and I'm going to look, amongst other things, I've decided to look at Caddyshack. Now, as a movie that was made in 1980, it falls right at the end of the paleo cinema era. But as one of the wildest fun comedies I know, I thought I'd have a talk about it. Don't know what else I'm going to throw together with it, but that's one of the things I'm going to be looking at next time around. We're going very lowbrow, but having fun with it next time around. So I'm going to leave you with a track that I found. It's by Rob McEwen, and it name checks a whole bunch of classic Hollywood stars. It's called The Beverly Hills Telephone Directory. So I'll just put that at the end of the podcast. And until 3 weeks from now, when I do all this all over again in a totally different way, enjoy your movie viewing. I hope everything's going well for all of you, and I will talk to you then. Goodbye.
Mary Beth Hughes, Huron Bay, June Allison, Francis Bay, Buster Crabbe, Irene Dunn, Lawrence Harvey, Bella Darcy.